Welcome back to Copper Country Today. I'm your host, Rick Allen. I've recently had some stories in the news that came from some very interesting conversations with people from or representing our area. Since I can only share a few seconds of those conversations with you in a news story, I thought you might like to hear what else they had to say. Later in the segment, I'll be joined by State Senator Tom Casperson and finally by U.S. Senator Gary Peters. But first off, the Sheriff of Keweenaw County, Ron Lotti. Sheriff, the Keweenaw County Board recently voted to convert the county jail into a 72-hour lockup facility. What can you tell me about the history of the jail?
The jail, Keweenaw County Jail, was built in 1886. It's been operating as a jail since then, so it's the longest, oldest operating jail in the state of Michigan. And in 1993, when I came into office, the Department of Corrections had condemned the facility. And at that time, we didn't feel like we wanted to lose our jail. So we got some grant monies and we renovated what we had here, the old jail. And we got busy. Things got busier. We had Keweenaw Academy in the county, and we had different laws changes. The drunk driving arrest, domestic violence arrest came up because of laws that changed that required people to be arrested and put in jail for things that maybe didn't happen 20, 30 years ago before that. So in 97, we found ourselves in a position that our jail was busy, our small jail, so we had to put an addition on. And at that time, we put the addition on here that brought our office here into this building. Our office prior was in a courthouse, so it wasn't a secure or safe situation to have our officers in one building and inmates in another. We couldn't monitor what's going on, so the whole thing was pulled together, and it really worked out well because the courthouse needed the room anyway, and we got our operations under one roof. So for the last 19 years, we've functioned as a full operating jail, operated under this roof, and it's worked really well for us.
How has the number of inmates being housed in the jail changed over the years?
The number of inmates has decreased. We are housing at 1.5 and 6 inmates per day on average for the year. And, my wife and I lived here for many, many years and operated the jail as kind of a family-run operation, kind of. Her and I would, she did the cooking taking care of answering phones and taking care of inmates' issues. And she was a certified corrections officer. She did that on her own. And we kind of kept it running, which kept the cost down. But over the years, the cost of running the jail went up due to a lot of Department of Corrections regulations with staffing for the jail. And, we kind of ended up in a situation where the cost of running the jail was going up and the number of inmates are going down due to drug courts we have today, which people that were sentenced to 3 and 6 months prior for drunk driving or domestic violence but alcohol-related issues maybe are now going into drug courts. They're not coming to jail, which is not a bad thing. It's a good thing. If you can rehabilitate people and correct them from their ways, that's a great thing, but it's caused our jail numbers to go down. And the cost of the jail is going up, so it's kind of like a perfect storm thing we had going on here that through the cost of running this really high and for a number of reasons. And the revenues in the county have been decreasing, what the county board tells me. So, they started looking at this issue as how can we cut some costs here? And that's where it ended up, where we went from a full, a jail that was, we were 100% compliant with jail rules. Everything was working fine here. But it's just the cost and the requirements to run a jail today from what they were even 20 years ago have changed so much that we were forced to look at other options. And now if we operate as a 72-hour lockup, our jail is still here. This will be an awesome 72-hour lockup facility. It'll work really great for the county. Anybody arrested here will still come here. If they can't post bond, they can't, for whatever reason, either they don't have the money or the bond is too high or the judge refuses bond, after 3 days they'll be moved to a different facility where they'll be held until they're through the court process. So things will still continue to operate as normal. We just won't have the staff here that requires to operate a jail, which saves the county probably around $100,000 a year at this point. And in the future, probably even more money it would cost. So that's what the board was looking at.
How many people are working here right now?
The staff, I have 5 deputies and myself. Prior, with the jail on top of it, we had a part-time employee, a half employee kind of that did the cooking and answering phones, helping out during the day in the office. And we had 2 full-time corrections officers that worked the evenings and nights.
How will staffing levels change after the jail is closed?
The 2 corrections officers and a part-time staff will be laid off. So that will save the county, with the cost of benefits and wages for those employees. And after you house in a neighboring county, you're still going to have a savings of probably close to $100,000 a year.
You called it an end of an era.
It is an end of an era. When you look at this place, it's part of our county. It's a tough thing for me because I fought since 1993 to keep our jail. and my wife and I run as a family operation, we were able to make that work. You know, it got tough at times. There were a lot of hours involved, but it was about keeping Keweenaw County's identity is how I looked at it, because it's part of your identity, anything with your county. But the reality today is with the rules and the money it costs to do it, I understand the logic behind what's happening here. Doesn't mean I have to agree with or like it, though. You know.
Is there any possibility that the jail could be reopened someday?
Oh, yeah, I mean, our jail is, like I said, 100% compliant, and if something down the road were to happen, that things change for whatever reasons, I don't see any reason why you couldn't just say, okay, we're going to start holding our inmates in our old county facility. Of course, I think we'd have to have an inspection done by the Department of Corrections to make sure we're still up to date. But other than that, I think, it would be okay, but If our jail numbers ever went up, and they would have to go up considerably to make that feasible financially again to do, that is possible.
When does the jail close?
April 1st.
You're known as the singing sheriff, so Keweenaw County is losing you as well as their jail. How long until retirement?
I have 9 months left.
What went into your decision to retire?
Well, I've had 37 years in law enforcement, 24 years as sheriff. I was as a young boy, my dream was to be a county sheriff one day, and thanks to the people in Keweenaw County, that dream came through. And I was able to serve for 24 years, six terms as sheriff, which is the longest serving sheriff in the history of the county. So it's been an honor, it's been a pleasure, and I want to see what else is out there in life. I've got a lot of grandchildren, I got a farm I want to work on, and I really want to just try something different. I've been doing this, like I said, for 37 years.
Will you and your wife remain in the county?
Oh yeah, we've got my wife and I have a property in Mohawk. We have 80-acre farm, and we're anxious to we'll be part of the community. We'll still be part of what's going on here. Just it will be, to function. It's going to be a hard adjustment for me as well. I mean, giving up something I love is not easy, but at the same time, we aren't getting any younger, and I think it's time to move on. I just feel it's time.
Do you and your wife still live in this building?
I still live at the jail. We still function as the jail. My wife is retired a year ago, so she's not here anymore. My daughter was doing some of the work here to help fill in with the cooking and that until the jail closed now. But so, it's been a slow progression out, kind of, and we'll cap it, at the end of the year I'll cap that off with retirement for myself. And it's been a wonderful 24 years as sheriff. I can't say anything bad about it. People have been great. It's been an interesting job, to say the least. We've seen some tragic things. We've seen some funny things. We've seen a lot of things change in a county, and we're able to make it work best for the people in a county. That's the thing. It was always about the county residents and making sure they got what they needed. And that was, if with that priority, you can't go wrong. So that's what we got functioned for.
Will the next sheriff live here?
The next sheriff, obviously, without the jail, it won't be such a requirement, because with modern technology, you have your phones can be transferred to a dispatch center. Your radios can be handled from, radio communications can be handled from anywhere. So a sheriff won't be as tied to the building as my family was, with the phones, the inmates, the radios. I don't see the next sheriff living here. I don't see them wanting to live here. It's kind of, I think, the end of an era. I think I'll probably be the last sheriff to raise a family here. I raised five children in his house. And it was interesting. My kids all have fond memories of it, even though there were some tough nights here when people coming into jail. This is only a wooden wall separating us, and you could hear the hollering and swearing going on. But my kids really, I was proud of the way they handled that and they dealt with that. They were really good about it. So it worked out well for us. And I just don't know that any other sheriff's going to want to do that. So
I certainly want to wish Ron Lottie a happy retirement and thank him for all he has done for Keweenaw County. I know all of you wish the same. Michigan's presidential primary was March 8th, and I had a chance to speak with State Senator Tom Casperson the following morning. Wanted to catch up with you after yesterday's primaries and sort of get your reactions. Of course, Bernie Sanders won on the Democratic side, and Donald Trump, as the polls had predicted, took the Republican presidential primary from Michigan. Everything kind of went as predicted on that end.
It did. We're getting a signal, and a good one, from the folks, the people themselves that are voting, and it clearly, to me, is a signal of dissatisfaction with status quo, and my hope and prayer is that leadership, who has a lot to do with driving the ship, leadership in the House, the Senate, and really out throughout government, sees that and hears that message and shakes things up, because I think that's what the people are demanding. I'm not so sure when you look at Bernie Sanders winning as an example. Bernie's, he's been honest with us in that he said he's a socialist. So he literally would want to change our entire way of governing and go to a socialistic type of government, but yet people gave them a vote. Well, that tells me that they're pretty frustrated, and they're even willing to go along with someone that would profess that. And so that is an eye-opener to me.
I can't recall an election, Senator, that had so many polarizing figures doing so well in the numbers. There's really no middle ground candidate to go along with this year.
Yeah, and I think it reflects the idea that the public is saying, at least the voters, the folks that are willing to go out and vote, are saying that they want to shake things up. They've watched how people have governed, and I think Washington has played a massive part in this. They've watched how they've governed in Washington. They haven't seen a whole lot of change. They see a lot of fighting, bickering, and pointing fingers and blaming people. And, no major changes when you could almost argue at times Rome is burning. Our economy has been struggling for a long time, and just a lot of things happening. When you look at the national level and you look at the global level with the rise of terrorism and just the instability that's out there, I think people want to see some change and something really being shaken up because the status quo is not working.
Now, you yourself are a Republican and you're running for U.S. Congress this year. If by chance Donald Trump was to run the table and become our next president, starting the same year that you are, would you be able to work with a President Trump?
Yeah, I think I can. I've been pretty good at trying to work with people. I would just hope that, some of the changes he's talking about, I think, challenging government, the internal workings of government, if he really means it, that he does it. And I would support that. You just don't know until it happens. You know, whoever gets in there, will they follow through with it? And that's been the unknown, and that's been, again, I think that gets back to the public's frustration, is they're tired of, they think people have said things and then never follow through with it.
Senator, I also wanted to ask you about, this would be Senate Bill 827. This involves with the DEQ and a special committee that you wanted to form, and the environmental groups they're not backing this one.
Yeah. Yeah, they're not. I've been trying to methodically work on issues that would kind of drive the ship back towards the citizen themselves versus allowing government departments to, what I believe has happened over the years, is literally legislate through rules. And so the citizen gets very frustrated. We have multiple calls with people that have gotten into a dispute with the agency, and mainly in this case, the DNR, or the DEQ, excuse me. And we find out too many times that the dispute is over a rule, not over a law. And so the rules are imposed by the departments. We don't have any say over that once they do it. The governor can stop it, but that's about it. I can go after the rule, but I got to gin up legislation, goes through the whole process. So this is designed to have some outside oversight over these rules so that the community that's going to have to live by these rules has some say in what these rules are going to say. And it's similar to the NRC with the DNR, the Natural Resource Commission, which was designed, really was a vote of the people in that case, to oversee and bring the voice of the people to the department to kind of force the issue that the department should listen to what the will of the people is. And this is similar. We've had a lot of success challenging kind of where the department was going in certain cases. This is just another step in that direction, and it's to make sure that, yes, we have laws, and yes, there will be rules, but they need to be reasonable, and people need to have a say in what this is. And it's really patterned after what the state of Indiana has done, and they've had great success with it, and we think we can do the same.
The opposition would characterize this as giving criminals the ability to have say in what laws get passed. In their view, the DEQ is meant to regulate those who could, pose a threat to the environment. So by giving them a seat at the table, so to speak, in this committee to be able to approve or veto a rule that the DEQ wants to pass, that you're basically giving them the keys to the kingdom, and it's to stop regulations from coming down the pipe.
Yeah, of course they're going to jump to the extreme on this thing. And quite frankly, watching how it has worked in the past, I think one of their concerns that they won't mention is the front row seat they've been given inside of these departments. And that's where the problem's coming from. They've been allowed to sit at the front row in the room with the departments when these rules are being crafted. So they have a flavor of whatever they want. and those being regulated end up having to live under it. And where I think we're getting off the rails is they're able to craft this kind of stuff, and these groups you're talking about really don't want to go before the legislature and make their case and get it into the law, because in many cases what they're asking for has been so extreme, there's no way that the legislature is going to go along with it. But they have had success sitting at the table with the departments and imposing some of this stuff within rules. And that's where we've had problems. And the reason that I'm comfortable with the panel is because it's an open process and everybody can weigh in on it. And at the end of the day, if the department feels that they were the rule, or even the environmental groups feel the rules don't go far enough, they are more than welcome to go to their legislature and say, we need a law that's going to require whatever it is they're asking for, because we need to protect the environment, and let the legislature vote it up or down. So they have that avenue as well, but they refuse to use it because it's worked much easier for them to work internally with the departments and not put it out in front of the light of day.
Senator Casperson, I'm looking forward to sitting down with you in April. You'll be in town, and we'll be on Copper Country Today, and that will be a good time, and I'll be able to talk to you a lot more then.
Sounds good. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Thank you for calling in. Have a great day. Now we check in with the junior U.S. Senator from Michigan, Gary Peters. Thank you for calling in. We got this chance here to talk to you about a couple of pieces of legislation that you're a part of recently. Let's start off first with the Making Education Affordable and Accessible piece that you've recently helped sponsor. Tell me about that.
Well, this legislation is focused on something that I'm focused on every day, and that's reducing the cost of college education for our students. Yes, college is becoming very, very expensive, and we're finding that many students who go to college, even though they may be working and getting scholarships and other types of help, still leave school with very large amounts of student debt. So anything we can to reduce the cost, we must do. And I find that probably one of the most effective ways to reducing the cost of college education is to help high school students, before they graduate, get as many college credits as possible that they can then apply to that degree. And that's why I'm working in a bipartisan way, working with one of my Republican colleagues from Louisiana, to work to get federal grants to help colleges, universities, and high schools put together dual and concurrent enrollment programs and expand the programs that they currently have. Certainly there are some in the UP now, Northern Michigan, other colleges and universities offer them. But what this does is basically allow students to either be simultaneously enrolled in both a college course as well as getting their high school diploma, or actually having concurrent enrollment, which means right there in a classroom in their high school, they just go to that classroom, take the course from normally one of their high school teachers who's qualified to certify college credits, and receive those credits. And the great thing about this is that some of these programs, when fully implemented, can mean a high school student can graduate with maybe 30 to 35 college credits, which is equivalent to the freshman year of college.
Now, I have a parent's view on this, since my daughter's 17. She's in one of these programs here in the Calumet schools in the Upper Peninsula, and I've seen a couple of benefits from it. One is that starting with her junior year in high school, she's college-minded, meaning she's looking forward to what college can do for her and is already making those steps to be ready. Because when she graduates high school, she's going to have quite a few credits already earned to her degree when she goes over to Michigan Tech.
Yeah, that's right, Rick. In fact, you know, you said it so well, and that's really the power of these programs, in addition to the fact that it reduces the cost of education. And the evidence is just so clear, and you look at the statistics, is that students who have taken these courses, either concurrent or dual enrollment, before they graduate from high school, their likelihood of actually completing the degree and getting that degree goes up dramatically. And it's a large part for the reasons you mentioned. Folks are thinking about college. They're working at it. Plus, you know, oftentimes folks sometimes have a hard time when they first go to school in that first year or two, and people will drop out at that time. But if you already have a large amount of credits, you already have a leg up on the situation, you're less likely to drop out. You're going to complete the degree and then be able to move on with your life. So it's powerful to save money and to make sure our students are actually getting their degree.
So you're open to expand on this program. Where does that sit right now, the legislation?
Well, we just introduced it in, as I mentioned, a bipartisan way. We're getting more sponsors, but I'm hoping to move it fairly quickly. We are in the Senate here, in the U.S. Senate. We're going to be taking up comprehensive higher education bill in the next month or two, which will deal with a whole variety of areas of higher ed. But I'm hoping to introduce this legislation as an amendment to that broader package to get it moving and be able to provide these grants to expand programming. You know, you mentioned your daughter's in the program now. We do have a number of these programs in Michigan. Currently, we need to expand those, in my mind. In fact, about 23,000 students across the state of Michigan are in dual enrollment, concurrent enrollment. That represents about 7% of the student population in our state. We need to increase that more than the 7%. And also, we'd like to offer more programming and have the resources available to have more courses. For your daughter example, that she would have a larger choice of courses to pick from. And the more courses she and others have to pick from, the more likely they'll be able to earn even more credits.
And lastly, on this topic, you mentioned that you had bipartisan support on this bill, but if you had any opposition, and I would think it would come from those wondering if our federal government should be putting money into education in this way. Do you see any of that?
No, you know, I haven't. In fact, we've got strong support from all of the major education groups. And this these grants programs are to help with professional training, things that we do now with the federal government. So the grants can be used for a couple purposes. One is to design the curriculum, just so you design the course before you offer it. And two, to have professional development. High school teachers, for example, before they can teach a course and award college credit, they normally have to go through some certification program that the colleges or universities will have. The limiting factor on all this tends to just to be the money that's available. So by providing grants to our local high schools and local colleges and community colleges, we'll be able to use that money very effectively to make these offerings. And in the process, save an awful lot of money to the students who are working to get their degree.
Another piece of legislation that you have out there, and this was with help of Congressman Dan Beneschek, who's from the Upper Peninsula, and of course Debbie Stabenow and Mike Quigley from Illinois. This is to help fund the Great Lakes Science Center, or at least pave the way so it's easily funded.
Oh, that's correct. You know, one of the most important industries that we have in Michigan is our fishing industry with the Great Lakes. We have very very robust fishing stocks, but we need to make sure that those fishing stocks continue to be robust for both recreational fishing as well as commercial fishing. It's about a $7 billion industry. It's a major industry for us. And in order to make sure that those fisheries continue to be healthy, it's important to constantly do ongoing research. And we have a Great Lakes Research Center that does that. Just like fishery research in the oceans and for saltwater fish stocks. But the unfortunate thing is that we always play second fiddle to that. There isn't the steady funding stream for Great Lakes fisheries as there is for the ocean fisheries. And so this legislation seeks to correct that and make sure there's steady funding, steady resources available for that so important research to make sure that the fish stocks we have today can stay healthy and hopefully grow and become even more healthier.
Will this money be used to help combat invasive species that threaten the Great Lakes?
It will. That'll be part of it, too. You know, that's part of the research that is done at these research centers is that, you know, hopefully, what will happen is we can stop that from coming in. So we're working with the Army Corps of Engineers and other folks to prevent the Asian carp from ever making it into the Great Lakes system. It would be catastrophic, but certainly if something like that were to happen, it's this kind of research which would be very important to try to mitigate it. But hopefully we'll stop it from happening in the first place.
Senator, I want to thank you for your time this morning coming on the show and talking about these things you have coming up. What's next for you?
Well, I'm continuing to work on advanced vehicle research as well as some scientific research issues, but doing a lot with manufacturing. In fact, I just spoke to a group of manufacturers this week and working to promote particularly small and mid-sized manufacturers, which is really the heartbeat of our economy. Certainly very important for the UP as well, good paying jobs. And I'm working to make sure that we have a very healthy dynamic when it comes to smaller manufacturing firms that need additional assistance.
And keep pushing for that expanded rail service. We're excited to hear about that.
Yes, yeah, and that's another thing which is part of that, and it really feeds into having smaller manufacturers, but also agriculture and and the forestry industry, which is so important in the UP, as well as mining. You know, it's short line rails are really critical for us in Michigan. In fact, we have about 22 short line rail companies, which is a pretty high number for our state, but it's primarily because we live on two peninsulas. And when you look at the major rail lines that go from the East Coast to the West Coast, it's easy to bypass two peninsulas, and that's why the short line rails are so important. So we're working on legislation to provide tax credits for them to improve their track beds and to improve their infrastructure so that they can provide the services that we need to our local miners and forestry folks and manufacturers and agricultural producers to make sure that our products get to the market and generate the revenue that we need to keep those businesses healthy.
Senator, thank you so much and have a terrific day.
Thank you, Rick. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
Copper Country Today will be right back.